Hello, I'm Kenny Walter, editor of ACP Live. Welcome to Doc Talk. ADHD is one of the most complex and underdiagnosed disorders in psychiatry, especially for adults. While the general population views ADHD as a disease involving impulsive and hyperactive children, many adults outgrow those symptoms but maintain the concentration problems throughout life. This is particularly prevalent for adult women. And oftentimes, adults with ADHD have comorbid psychiatric conditions like depression and anxiety, which substantially increases the risk of mortality. In this episode of Doc Talk, I'm joined by Dr. Teresa Cerulli of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Dr. Cerulli is an expert in ADHD and talked about how there are common myths and misconceptions regarding adults with ADHD. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Cerulli.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Doc Talk podcast. I'm with Dr. Teresa Cerulli to talk about complex ADHD. Dr. Cerulli, can you start by just introducing yourself and tell the audience a little bit about your background and history treating ADHD?
Yes, hi, I am Dr. Teresa Cerulli, a neuropsychiatrist in the Boston area. I have, as a neuropsychiatrist, I have an interest in the interface between general medicine and psychiatry, and especially neurology and psychiatry. I still teach with the residents through Harvard Longwood Psychiatry Residency Training Program and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And then I have my private practice specializing or subspecializing in ADHD in North Andover, Massachusetts, where I've been working with kids, adolescents, and adults with ADHD for about 20 years now.
Okay, well, thank you for joining me. Just start things off. I saw in a previous interview where you said there's a clinical myth that ADHD is easy to treat. Why does this myth exist? And what can we do to kind of advocate that this is really untrue and there is such a thing as complex ADHD?
It's a topic near and dear to my heart. Let me start by saying this, having done this professionally 20 years, and I also have a daughter with ADHD who's now 17. So I've watched the evolution of how we even define the condition and some of the updates. So let me start by saying that simple ADHD only exists about 25% of the time, and complex ADHD, therefore, about 75% of the time. Complex ADHD is specifically defined by criteria that came out from the Society for Developmental Behavior and Behavioral Pediatrics, the SDBP guidelines in 2020. So when I'm saying complex ADHD, this is not a term Dr. Cerulli made up. It's actually a very specific guidelines provided in 2020 by the SDBP. So it's a myth to say that it's a clinical myth to say that ADHD is easy to treat because ADHD in itself is not an easy condition to accurately diagnose because of the complexities.
Is this myth with the general population, or is it in fact with doctors and people in medical research?
I think a little bit of both in my experience. It depends who you talk to. I just say that there's a lot of misinformation out there. The condition is both overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed. The condition is both overtreated and undertreated. So I think it depends who you're talking to.
Okay. Now you mentioned both, I guess, simple or standard ADHD and complex ADHD. How would you define complex ADHD? And is there a way to differentiate between what might be considered the simpler form and the more complex form?
The guidelines I mentioned are the go-to on this of the what is complex ADHD. We, in our field and medicine in general, try to refer to the guidelines to help us make such distinctions. And then every 10, 20 years or so, you'll see guidelines for different conditions get updated. So it was exciting that in 2020, we did get an update to the SDBP guidelines on complex ADHD. So rather than giving my definition, I'll tell you what their definition is, since that's where it's originated. Complex ADHD is defined by any of the following: presence or even suspicion of coexisting disorders and complicating factors, meaning not just comorbidities, but any kind of complicating factors that can be socioeconomic factors, for example. That's not a psych diagnosis, it's a factor. Second, moderate to severe functional impairment. In other words, the level of functional impairment matters. If it's high, that's considered complex ADHD. Diagnostic uncertainty on the part of the primary care clinician. In other words, if you are having to refer to a specialist, it is probably going to be a complex ADHD situation. Inadequate response to treatment or uncertainty about treatment planning. That is also part of the definition of complex ADHD. And then finally, age criteria, either less than 4 years old or greater than 12 years old at initial symptom presentation defines complex, is another defining factor for complex ADHD. Because normally in the DSM criteria, which is the definition of simple ADHD, if we're going just straight DSM, and we are now up to DSM-5, of course, that's simple ADHD. And that age criteria does not include the kids less than 4 years old and greater than 12. And so by definition, if we're in that age range, it's complex.
Okay. Now, you mentioned overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed. Looking at underdiagnosed, does the disease become more complex as the patient ages, and will it become more complex if it's left undiagnosed longer, meaning you see that the patient may be having this disorder for a number of years, but you don't see the patient or diagnose the patient until a certain period of time where they've been dealing with it for so long?
Mm-hmm. What I would say to that is that the condition itself, the core ADHD symptoms, that's the simple ADHD, in other words, the DSM criteria that somebody meets in inattention and hyperactive impulsive symptoms, that the trajectory often looks as though the cognitive symptoms persist through life, and if anything, the hyperactive impulsive symptoms improve. They lessen, or at least they shift, or what is getting worse, and particularly if the ADHD has been unaddressed, unmanaged, and untreated, are the comorbidities. So the question you asked is an interesting one. If you're looking at core symptoms, my answer is they stay pretty consistent. People tend to learn management strategies for some of the core features of ADHD. But the comorbidities, if the ADHD hasn't been well managed, the comorbidities get worse often. And the statistics I'm about to give you are rather frightening ones. And I say this to help people understand why it's so important to pick up on the comorbidities. The psychiatric comorbidities actually increase risk for not just morbidity, but mortality rates in adults with ADHD. I did say that mortality. So the risk of death goes up the more you add comorbidities to the ADHD diagnosis. Some specifics: if you have just ADHD alone, just simple ADHD, no comorbidities, your risk of death is the hazard ratio is 1.56. So you're 1.5 times greater risk of death with just even having ADHD. Think about it: impulsivity, you know, driving a car, impulsive and inattentive to details, you might be at more risk for accidents, for example. Okay, so that's already scary in and of itself, but now let's start adding the comorbidities. ADHD plus one comorbidity, your hazard ratio goes up 4.2. In other words, 4.2 times greater risk of death if you have even one comorbidity with ADHD. How about if you have two or more comorbidities, which, by the way, 60% of patients with ADHD meet that mark, two or more psychiatric comorbidities with their ADHD, your risk of death is 8.57, so 8.5 times greater risk of death than if you don't have ADHD. That's ADHD plus two comorbidities that I just gave you. And the list goes up from there. So I'm going to pause and say that, remember, 75% of patients with ADHD have at least one comorbidity, and 60% have at least two or more comorbidities. So the numbers I just gave you apply to the majority of our ADHD patients.
Is that what makes it so difficult to diagnose? Because you also have to diagnose the depression or the anxiety or the OCD involved. And there's, like you said, 75%. So there's at least two diagnoses that you have to make when you know, first looking at a patient.
Right. Right. 75% of the time, there are at least two diagnoses there. So the question you ask is so right on for where we are at in the evolution of how to think about diagnosis. The old paradigm was treat the ADHD first, and a lot of what we felt were secondary symptoms like the depression, the anxiety. A lot of those secondary symptoms or comorbidities would probably get better if you managed the ADHD. That was the old paradigm. The new paradigm, and this comes from the SDBP guidelines in 2020. And let me add, there was also updates in late 2019 from the American Academy of Pediatrics along these same lines, talking about comorbid ADHD. So both entities are really pushing for the new paradigm that I'm about to say, which is identify both the ADHD and the comorbidities simultaneously and treat them simultaneously. That's the push in our guidelines and how to properly manage and treat this condition. So old paradigm, treat ADHD first, maybe the other condition will get better. New paradigm, you have to really, really take a step back, identify not just the ADHD, but the what else is there 75% of the time so that you can diagnose and treat them simultaneously.
And does that make treating psych conditions, really psych conditions in general, but ADHD specifically, so much more difficult to treat than you know, inflammation in an organ or something like that? Because you can't just devise like a one size fits all treatment plan. Everything has to be so individualized for the specific patient.
It's what I love about my job, Kenny. It really is. I started out saying, as a neuropsychiatrist, I'm interested in the interface between medicine and psychiatry, and always have been. It's just fascinating. And yes, it does make it more challenging. Every patient is unique, but it is what I love about my job, is we're separating out what's medical and what's psychiatric, how they interact with one another and present in the body and in the mind. So I've found this an incredibly rewarding path to take in life. It is the art and science of what we do.
Yeah, very good to hear. You mentioned recently updated guidelines. How important is it to constantly be looking at how we look at every disease and what the best course of action is, and to update these guidelines at least every couple of years with new research, since we're always doing research in ADHD and always looking at things?
I think it's so important. It's they're the guidelines and the guardrails, really. It's how we, because there's so much new information all the time. It's why many of us are so subspecialized, but it's hard to keep up with as a general practitioner anymore, because there's just incredible amounts of data coming in from the science side every day. So the guidelines, at least, it's a way to have people on top of taking what they can from the research and helping us in clinical practice to know how to apply the research that's been done, is the way I would think about it. So yeah, it would be nice if there were guidelines more frequently than we do get them. In fact, for adult ADHD, you may be surprised to hear, we actually don't even, in the United States, we don't have diagnostic and treatment guidelines for adult ADHD. There are European guidelines, but we don't have them here in the US. So we borrow from the American Academy of Pediatrics, actually, when we're talking about treatment guidelines, or the SDBP, which is also pediatrics.
Interesting. And is there, I'm glad you mentioned adult ADHD. Is there a real difference? I know there's going to be a difference between basically what we've talked about, between the way every patient kind of manifests disease, but is there a discernible difference between an adult with ADHD that's been treated and diagnosed as an adolescent and an adult first being diagnosed with ADHD?
There's certainly looking at outcomes, it certainly does seem to matter that if one has treated this condition, that the ability to reduce morbidity and even mortality is significantly impacted in the positive direction. So accurate diagnosis could certainly significantly change life outcomes. And the example I just gave you about, we're not talking about just accidents and doing poorly in school and struggles with parenting and peer relationships. And we're talking about mortality rates here too.
Okay. With that said, are there any treatments in the pipeline that you think will particularly help complex ADHD patients, either in adult or pediatric populations?
Yeah, I'll start by where we've come from before the what's in the pipeline. So some of the overlapping conditions with ADHD that do make it more complex are, for example, medically based, like tic disorders. We know that some kids, there's an increased risk and rate of tic disorders comorbid with ADHD. And for those, for years and years, we've known that stimulants may not be a good option for those kiddos because the stimulants tend to exacerbate the tics, exacerbate the comorbidity. So where we've come from, medications like extended release guanfacine, known as in the brand name Intuniv, when that came out 10 plus years ago, that was our go-to for the kids with ADHD and comorbid tics, because it turns out guanfacine also has some benefit in treating tic disorders. So part of what I'm, and my answer to the question of the what may be in the pipeline when I'm thinking about how to apply the new information when the new medications coming on board, it's the, well, what is the chemical structure of that medication known to do from our history, such as we know guanfacine had some benefit in tic disorders long before it came out for treating ADHD. I'm thinking about that with the pipeline medications. When you have a lot of comorbidities with ADHD, I tend to lean towards these non-stimulants because this, depending on the comorbidity, obviously, but the stimulants tend to exacerbate anxiety, for example, the tic disorders, sometimes mood disorders with the wear-off effects. Obviously, if you have a patient that's got ADHD and substance abuse, the stimulants carrying a black box warning for abuse and dependence, that's a contraindication for prescribing controlled substances. So there are reasons with this complex ADHD picture, I look towards the non-stimulants, such as I just gave. Here's my long-winded answer. So in the pipeline, and not just in the pipeline, but already available for kids, Supernus came out with the non-stimulant Qelbree. It sounds like a K, but it actually starts with the letter Q. Qelbree it's approved for kids ages 6 to 17 years old. It is a non-stimulant for ADHD. It's being studied for adults now as well. I think the FDA is going to get back to Supernus in April of 2022, whether or not it gets that approval. But the reason I mention this at this point as a new non-stimulant for ADHD that's available is this drug has an interesting history. The generic name is viloxazine, and it was available in Europe for many, many years, viloxazine in its short acting form as an antidepressant. And you don't hear about that in the US because it's not available in the US and was never studied for depression here. But viloxazine's history is that chemical was approved and used in Europe for many, many years for depression. So some of these complex cases, there may be some benefits beyond just treating the core symptoms of ADHD if you look towards the history and chemical nature and mechanism of action of some of these drugs in the pipeline.
And then I guess my final question would be, we seem to be learning a lot more about complex ADHD every day and every year. What advice would you give doctors and how to best treat and care for patients with complex ADHD?
First and foremost, look for it, identify it. So if you can, you can't treat something you haven't yet identified. So with complex ADHD, just a quick reminder, there were some very specific criteria you may want to look at to be able to truly identify that that is the patient in front of you, that they're falling into that 75%. And then you want to identify what aspect of that case, that person, that patient in their life makes it qualify as complex. What are those factors? And then you can adequately treat both the ADHD and that factor you've identified. And as I said, factors aren't necessarily comorbidities. So you're going to screen for the comorbidities as you do in all of your patients, but you're also going to take into consideration some of those other factors in life that may be impacting the patient to make this a complex case and treat that as well.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining me. Do you have any closing thoughts on complex ADHD?
First, let me just say thanks for having me today. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Kenny. And yeah, I know I'm excited about the evolution in our diagnostic guidelines that there is such a term as complex ADHD, and it's not meant to scare people away from treating this condition. Hopefully the opposite, that they understand that there's a term to put towards what you're already seeing in your practices. You've known it right along.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kenny. Take care.
Thank you. And have a nice holiday.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
I'd like to thank Dr. Cerulli for joining me on this episode of DocTalk. And thank you for listening. For all the latest ADHD news, please visit acplab.com. And follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again. I'm Ken Walter.